Greetings. Welcome back to the seminar series. I'm really happy to welcome Dr. Elizabeth Thompson here today. Betty was for a long time a professor of sociology and demography in the University of Wisconsin at Madison. About 10 years ago, she moved to Stockholm, where she now leads the demography unit at Stockholm University. Betty is a really prolific and very influential demographer, and she works on many topics to do with family, relationships, and well-being, and childbearing decision, and so on. So I saw Ursula today, and she said that she was mystified by the the topic, childbearing across partnership. So without further ado, maybe I should just ask Betty to tell us more about this
topic. Thank you very much, Wang. I'm really happy to be here, and I have to say my husband and I decided to take a weekend break and come a couple days early, and we've had apparently one of the most fabulous weekends you could have in Oxford, and really enjoyed, you know, walking around in the city, and yesterday we went out to the Trout and walked along the river, and it's been fabulous. So I'm not only honored to come here and talk to you and hear what you have to say, but I've had a wonderful time doing it. So now I have to earn my keep. So what is this thing, childbearing across partnerships? Actually, at the very end of this talk, I will refer to another term that's been used. Some of you may already know it and tell you why I'm using childbearing across partnerships. But actually, one of the things you might be able to help us do is find a better name for this. but here's some very simple examples. We have a couple here in the middle who've just had a new baby, but the woman has had a child with a prior partner, so she's having childbearing across partnerships. In other words, she's producing half-siblings, a half-sibling for her older child, and her younger child comes into the world with a half-sibling. Or it can happen the other way around, where the man is the one who's having childbearing across partnerships. He's got two prior children, and providing a half-sibling for those two older children. And of course, it can happen both ways, where this new baby comes into the world with three older half-siblings, one from the mother's side and two from the father's side. So that's basically what the phenomenon is about, is having children where among all of your own children, they don't all have the same other parent. We know a lot about the process through which this happens, so we start out with non-union childbearing. When a child is born to a couple who don't live together, that union is, by definition, not a very stable union. So it's highly likely that women and men who have children without being co-residing with each other will go on and, if they have other children, have them with different partners. And then, of course, we have, in many countries, very high or increasing levels of separation and divorce after parenthood, which also contributes to the pool of persons who are at risk of having children with new partners. And these separations and divorces very often occur in the childbearing years when couples' partners are still able to find new partners and still be able to have children. The fact that there's increasing levels of cohabitation, and cohabitation, even when couples have children together, the cohabiting couples are more likely to split up than the married couples, means that there is an increasing pool of people in these, not so much increasing in non-union births, in fact that's been going down somewhat in some countries, but separation and divorce is more than making up for it. So overall, in many countries, there's an increasing pool over the last several decades of people who are at risk of forming new partnerships, the repartnering process, and then having children in those new partnerships. forming a new partnership that's co-resident dramatically increases, as you would expect, the likelihood of going on to have children with another partner. I've done a lot of work, and Ursula Hans is on a couple of one paper together and several she's done, and some I've done, on step-family childbearing, and we've demonstrated, I think unequivocally, that there is a new motivation to have children in a new partnership, even if the two of you together already have two or three children, that there are extra children being born in step-families that wouldn't be born if each of the partners had stayed in their original partnership. So, to date, I should mention, all of this research has to do, except with non-union births, has to do with childbearing in residential partnerships. So we don't have any research, as far as I know, or much research on the entry into what we call a living apart together or LAT relationship. And certainly, I don't think anybody has looked at the childbearing in a step family that is not co-resident, that is with a new partner. But that amount of childbearing is very small. It's not going to be much of the picture. And each of the transitions has generated a lot of research. But only recently have people sort of started thinking about going from the first birth onto the next and the next to see sort of the cumulative effect of the non-union birth, separation, divorce, repartnering, and step-family childbearing, and consider this new kind of childbearing with a new partner producing half-siblings instead of full siblings as perhaps a different kind of fertility event. So that's what several other people before me, and now I and some other colleagues are looking at. And at the end, we'll come back to the question of whether this is even useful. But for the moment, I'm going to assume that you think it might be useful. So what we know, when I started doing this work, the published research, we sort of had some cross-sectional data. That is, we could look and say, well, in a population, what proportion of parents have had children with more than one partner? And here is a couple of a few estimates. The first published data that I found is the study by Marcy Carlson and Frank Furstenberg of the U.S. Fragile Family Study. This is based on mothers giving birth in hospitals in 8 urban areas in the U.S., and the hospitals generally disproportionately served disadvantaged people. So this is not a representative sample of mothers. And of those mothers, 23% of them were having a child after having had a child with a different father. The other 77% either were having their first child or had their all previous children with the same man. But a more representative study of U.S. fathers showed that about 20% of fathers had a child with another partner, or had a child with more than one woman. But again, this goes across all age groups, so some of those fathers haven't had a chance to have two children or have them with more than one woman. The two estimates for Danish fathers and Norwegian fathers is much lower. And it's kind of interesting that most of the early research actually looked at fathers, because they kind of assumed that, oh, the work on women has been done and what's new is fathers. But in fact, the work on women hadn't been done yet. And so we've tried to fill in some blanks. But the percentages in Denmark and Norway of men who are nearing the end of their childbearing years was much lower. But of course, you can't have children with two or more partners unless you have two or more children. So it might make more sense to just look at the proportion of the two plus child parents. Whoops, sorry. I think I pushed the off button. Okay. Sorry, I'm not used to this. Okay. So this is the percent of people who have at least two children. And for these U.S. disadvantaged, some of them disadvantaged urban mothers, it's more than a third. But even here, for the representative sample of fathers, it's almost a third in the U.S. But we have some other data from Australia mothers and fathers who are at the end of their childbearing years. And the percentages, even among those who have two children, is not so high as the U.S. So the U.S. looks like a real outlier. And in Denmark, the fathers are not that different, around 14%. So the estimates for the 2+ were not published for Norway. So the point is that It's not a majority phenomenon, even among those with two children, but it's a substantial minority, and there appear to be considerable differences across institutional contexts. Now, an important part of childbearing across partners, or an important aspect of childbearing across partnerships, is that it's an increasing component of relatively high fertility or higher family sizes. So these are data on women that my colleagues Trudy Lapagard, Marcia Carlson, Ann Evans, and Edith Gray have put together. And this is coming from last year's PAA presentation that's almost revised and ready to submit, but not quite. So it's still open to some input. And it shows the proportion of women who have children with two or more fathers among women who have two, three, four, or five children. So in Australia, Norway, and Sweden, you can see there's a fairly stable upward in proportion until we get up here, 40%. This number probably is not robust because it's a very small number of cases in their sample. These are based on hundreds of thousands because they're based on register data. So 40% in Norway and Sweden of people who have made it to five children have children with more than one partner, even though this is a small proportion of the population. But with three children, which is not that uncommon, a fairly more than a fifth are having those children essentially in step families. So this is kind of what we would expect with the processes that we've studied in step family fertility, where you get extra children when you form new partnerships. So we would expect the women or the men to end up with more children, and that in that direction. So of those who end up with more children, a big chunk are having children across partnerships. Why the USA looks like this, I think, is primarily due to the fact that a big proportion of first births in the United States are births to women living alone. And in the data that we use, as I will tell you later, if you have a child living alone, we assume that your next birth is with a different partner, because we can't identify in the data the partners. If we could, it might be different. But because there's such high levels of non-union births, and so first births are disproportionately in the U.S. born into very unstable unions, leaving women with very young children who can easily be absorbed more easily into a new relationship, you have a high proportion of those women forming a new relationship at fairly young ages and having second births, and the same thing is happening at third births. But when you get to the women with three and four, they just look pretty much like the other countries.
So you believe these Americans?
Yes.
They look completely incredible to me.
In terms of?
Yes,
and the selection bias is of the women who have two children, a fairly high
All American women who have two children, a third of those
have the second child with a different man.
Okay.
It's weighted for oversampling of Hispanics and African Americans, which have even higher rates. Americans are the champions of union dissolution and non-union childbearing. But I will check them, but I have checked them. And these are not based, I mean, the American data are based on a total sample of around 10,000 women, so it's not like there's no women in the categories.
Why can't you
believe it? It just seems to... You think this is a really rare event, and what I'm trying to say is no, it's not. So.
No.
But here, where I actually, no, it's not negligible here either. But you're right; it's so much higher in the U.S. But that is because a chunk of this is Part of this could be due to estimation because we aren't able to determine in the data whether the, let's say a woman has a child, she's not living with a man. She has a second child, it's with the same guy, but they never live together. We count that. So these probably are, both here and in Australia, slightly overestimated. And this will have a bigger effect here because there are more of them among women who have two children, a much higher, like, I think it's, in our data, at least a quarter of the first births are out of union, and or at least 20%. And then it's very likely a high proportion of those go on to have two children, and they have them with another person. So that drives that up. But it may be slightly overestimated. Okay, now, so far I've been showing you kind of states, okay, children that people have. But I am a demographer. And when one of my colleagues in sociology wanted to have the demographers come in a series and talk about what's the real key thing in each sub-area of sociology, my first answer immediately was time. And then I said, no. What I mean is exposure to risk. And if you know what exposure to risk is, then you can be a demographer. So demographers don't want to just look at what people have done or wait until people are past childbearing and see what they did in the past. They want to know what they're doing right now. And the way that they do that is they look at people who are at different stages of childbearing and look at the risk that they will make a transition. So we wanted to study the risk of having a child with another partner. And I'm going to walk you through how I do that and why I do it in a particular way. But that will be something we can discuss as well. And it's very much just like the risk, birth risk. I mean, that's what demographers do. We estimate these risks that are not, they're at the aggregate level oftentimes. I mean, they're not, the individual can't have a risk. It's only the population that we can observe. But we can look at differentials in the risk. And if you aren't happy with exposure to risk and you just want to think probability, you can roughly think probability or the chance or the likelihood. But it really is a constant exposure to the possibility that we look at. So I'll walk you through, because not all of you are demographers. We start out observing a woman, typically in fertility research, at some young age, like 15. And actually, we've now changed to 16. And we start out observing them, and we're waiting for them to have a birth. And so during all this time they haven't had a birth, they're at risk of having their first birth. And we can look at how this risk varies with lots of characteristics of the woman or with things that change over time, like her age. But we want to, in this case, distinguish two risks. The risks of having a child with one person or with two. Now, with the first birth, it's only one person. You don't have a child with two fathers. That's not what we're interested in. So here's an example, a way that we could specify this. We have a woman, and I also put in P is partnership, B is birth. So I put in P's and the ending of P and the new P because I wanted to make clear that in this analysis, we're observing this woman all through her non-fertile partnerships up until she has a first birth. And in this figure, we're saying all of this time she's at risk of having children with the same partner. But now that partnership ends, and now she's at risk of having a child with two or more partners. So that's one way we could do it. We just start observing people when they finish their first fertile partnership, and we see what happens afterwards. And that's kind of the way we've done the step family analyses. We watch people when they enter a step family and then look at their birth risk compared to people who have similar characteristics but are not in a step family. The problem with this approach is that we can never have a competing risk of having children with the same partner, children with a different partner, or no children at all. Because during this period, if we specify this period, we can only have a risk of having a second child with the same partner. And in this period, we can only have a risk of having a child with a new partner. So instead, and we need to come back to this maybe at some point, we have started every woman to have the risk of having a child with a new partner after her first birth. And we essentially ignore what's going on here. So whether she's in her first partnership or out of it, has formed a second partnership, we don't worry about that. We look at partnerships here only to determine whether the father is the same one or a different one. So let me give you a couple of scenarios. So here we have a woman, and we don't observe, you can't be at risk of having a child with another partner until you've had a child. So that part's irrelevant. And then we start observing this woman at parity one. And we know here she's in a partnership, but I'm not going to worry about that. Then she goes ahead and she has a child with the same father. And then we start observing her again to see if her third birth will occur at all with the same man or with a different man. Another scenario is we have this woman, she has her first birth, we don't observe her, we start observing at first birth, and we keep observing even though she's ended a partnership and started a new partnership, and then she has a birth, and it's with a different father. And in our analysis, having a child with a different partner is an absorbing state. So we aren't trying to predict every birth, whether it's with the same or a different partner as the previous one, which we could. That would be another interesting analysis. We just let the person be censored after this, whether she goes on to have 3, 4, 5 children with this other partner. She has experienced the event of childbearing across partnerships, produced at least one half-sibling for her among her children. And so that's what our analysis essentially looks like. Now let's see where I am. Do I have another picture? No. Okay. So in the first paper where I want to give you some results, we had 4 countries. Originally the design was, you know how lots of cross-national analyses have one country representing this welfare state and one country representing this. So we thought, well, let's have a 2x2. We'll have some within welfare state variability. We'll have Australia and the U.S. in the sort of liberal market welfare state, and we'll have Sweden and Norway. Unfortunately, which we knew in advance but hadn't thought carefully about, our measurement is also confounded with welfare state regime, but it doesn't matter too much because we don't find a clear welfare state regime difference in our results. So we have the HILDA survey, which is now part of the European and abroad generations and gender survey. There's an Australian version. I think it's been actually released now for analysis. We have the U.S. National Survey of Family Growth. We combine 1995 and 2006, 2008. That's a rotating continuous survey now. So we get around 10,000 cases. And cover periods because the NSFG has an age limit of 44 for women and 49 for men, and HILDA does not. So HILDA can go back further than we can with the 2006 NSG, so we got some earlier cohorts there. And then in Norway, we can observe, we observe from 68 to 2007 events that are going on. And the reason we start at 68 is because we did want to control in some of our models for marital status at first birth, and it's only from 68 that we know if a child was born in marriage. But we selected in all women who were born 1952 to 1991 who had it, and we start observing them when they have a birth, and they have to have had that birth at 16 to 45, partly because of the survey, the U.S. survey limitations. We wanted to have the same window for all the countries. And then we censor, as I showed you, after they've had a birth with a new partner, or if they haven't yet experienced that event, the last observation at age 45 or death. So it's a fairly straightforward analysis. I'll get back to the analysis in a minute. Here are some more descriptive results, but they're not across all the women. They're going to be subsets of women. This first graph, I forgot to tell you about identifying fathers. So in Australia and the U.S., the only way we can do it is because we know the woman's partner history and her birth history. So we have assigned children to a union if they were born in the union, up to 6 months before the union, or up to 9 months after the union, because of where they were conceived. And if they are out of a union, only if they were at least 9-10 months after a previous union and at least 7 months before a subsequent union. Then we assume that if the first birth was out of a union, that it fell in one of these windows, the next birth was assumed to be with a different father, whether it was in a union or not, as long as that union happened more than 6 months later. In Norway and Sweden, we have register data where we can identify the fathers of each woman's child. There's an ID, not a real ID number, but a serial number. If, for some women, a small percentage, the father's serial number is missing for any given child, we assume that child has a different father than other children. Even if two of them have the father missing, we assume those are different fathers, although they might not be. And it's a small percentage, and some of it, of course, is artificial insemination of lesbian partners or single women living alone. And the artificial insemination of lesbian partners has to occur in Denmark because it's still illegal in Sweden. You have to have two parents lesbian partners can be artificially inseminated because there's two partners. A single woman cannot. She has to go to Denmark. But she gets to register her birth in Sweden. So here we have, now these are all the mothers who had, all the mothers. So this is all of our samples who had, that we look at, who had one child. And this is the percent who had no second birth, the percent who had a second birth with the same father, and who had a second birth with a different father. There's no risk in here. This is just what we observed by the end of the period. And you can see that the U.S., as in many other respects, is a real outlier. It has slightly higher proportion who haven't had a second birth, but a very significantly larger proportion, especially the green in relation to the red of the second birth with a different father. So this is not like the previous data, because it's not all women who stopped at two, it's all women who had at least two children or who had one child. And it's all women who had one child, no matter how many more they had. So the percentage, the ratio of the green to the red in the U.S. is a quarter. So a quarter of the women who had a child, who had a second child, regardless of how many more they had, had that second child with a different man than the first. And as I said, that could be slightly overestimated if these non-marital, non-union births, actually the next birth was with the same man. Australia, the ratio of the green to the red is 18%, 14% for Norway, and 10% for Sweden. So in this respect, Australia does kind of fall in between the U.S. and the Nordic countries. Now I'm going to go on to a new figure that isn't related to any you've seen before. It will pick up only the reds, the women who had two children with the same father, and look at whether they had a third birth. And the blue shows that most of them didn't. Two-child family norm is very strong, especially when it's two children in the same partnership. And of those who did have a third birth, a smaller proportion had a different father. So here we have selected women who are already in partnerships that are sufficiently stable that they had two children together, and then many of them didn't have a child. Many of them did have a child, and a few of them had a different father, and it looks not that different across. It's about 5, you can see it's sort of 5% across the top in the green, and the ratio is between 6 and 16%, but it's mostly, in most cases, around 10%. Now, these are pretty small percentages for these transitions we're looking at, but once you accumulate them up over the going to the second birth, going to the third birth, going to the fourth birth, which looks pretty much like this, only the greens get a little bit smaller, then you get more women who at some point in their childbearing career have experienced having children with more than one partner. So, as I said, we want to model this. So we use a discrete time hazard model because we have a competing risk. We have three possible outcomes after each in each observation. So observations start after the first birth, or after two births with the same man, or after three births with the same man, or after four births with the same man. And then we stop at five. We have, at any point, you can have another birth. You can not have a birth. You can have another birth with the same man or another birth with the different man. So that's why we use the multinomial discrete time hazard. And it becomes a hazard because we have a duration dependence in it, which is the calendar years since the previous birth and years squared. So that creates a hazard model that's not continuous time, but works for this competing risk. And then in our models, we have the age at first birth, whether the woman was married and divorced before the first birth, the decade in which this interval starts, that we start observing the risk of the next birth, and how many children she had with the first father. So everybody's pooled in here, but we do have a separate indicator for the number of children with the first father. Then we looked at socioeconomic status, the mother's education, her mother's education, and whether the mother is an immigrant. And in this, our interest was, we thought that the socioeconomic differentials would be lower in the two social democratic welfare states than in the liberal market states, but in fact, we didn't find that. So our welfare state regime story is kind of, may not be the main story. So what I'm going to show you are some really complicated graphs that I will take you through step by step. So don't get panicked. The first one is going to show you the next graph is complicated. It's going to show you an interaction that we found between education and period. So we wanted to look at educational differentials in having a child with a different partner in relation to educational differentials in having a child with the same partner across time. And we did find statistically significant interactions in all four countries. So, okay. What we have here, first of all, the blue is women with compulsory education, red secondary, green tertiary. On this side of the graph, we have the relative risks across time with the same partner, and on this side with a new partner. So just look at the blue lines. Try to focus on blue. So you see that we have here a decline. Oh, this is for the U.S. I'm sorry, because I have one for every country, but I'm not going to show you all the countries. This is for the U.S. So the compulsory, they go down into the 1990s. This was during the period when we had the economic crisis in Sweden, and then it goes up a bit. But what's really dramatic is that the relative likelihood of having a child with another partner is skyrocketing, I would say. Going, this is the 1970s, and the relative risk goes up to 1.5 and almost 2 in the 2000s. If we look at the secondary educated, we see somewhat of a decline in having children in the same partnership over time, and an increase and then kind of a leveling off. But for the college educated, it's kind of flat with the same partner, and it's bumping around. And in all cases, the college educated are lower in having children with the with a different partner. And here in the U.S., they're not so much different in having children with the same partner. Now we're going to look at the same graph in Sweden. Australia is actually flatter on education, although it still shows this pattern. And Norway is a little bit more differentiated in education on this side of the graph than Sweden is. But you can see that Sweden is still pretty differentiated, except that even among the secondary and the college educated, there's still it still goes down with education. But here it's gone up over time pretty much for everybody. But here you see a real shift, which we've already been documented as part of the fertility story, that those with secondary and especially tertiary education are more likely to continue to a birth in the same partnership than those with compulsory. And this, the overall fertility is positive with education in Sweden now and also in Norway, telling us that once you get rid of the opportunity costs, the income effect on childbearing takes over. But it's in both cases, what we end up with in all of these four countries in the 2000s is an increased differentiation among educational groups in the nature of their childbearing. So among those with compulsory education, there's been an increasing proportion who have children with more than one partner, and among those with college education, if anything, decreasing, but certainly no increase, not a big increase. And the same thing is true in all these countries. So this could be part of another incidence of what Sarah McClanahan has called diverging destinies. She's looked, and others have looked, at educational differences in divorce and educational differences in non-union births and just single-parent families and time with children and that sort of thing. But as far as I know, this is the first documentation of this diverging destiny with regard to what is a fairly complex family form. That her argument is that disadvantaged, socioeconomically disadvantaged people are increasingly also disadvantaged in terms of the complexity of the family lives they have to deal with, and that's a sort of a double disadvantage for the parents and for their children.
Is this correct for age or not?
It is. It's corrected for age at first birth, and then it's the duration. So no, it's not. It not got a correction for the age at the time of risk, because that would be, it wouldn't, for the second birth it would be completely collinear. For the third, we could put in age at the previous birth and then let the duration go.
It's just because there's a strong gradient in women of various educational stages.
Right, but we control for age at first birth. So it would only have any difference if there were, if the true age at second birth had an independent effect, I think. I mean, there's other ways of modeling this, which is to just model births and look at the effect of being in a second partnership or having left. So that could be done. Two. That's another alternative way of modeling it, rather than as a competing risk. And this kind of competing risk also makes assumptions that there isn't this, you know, it's really a choice between one or the other, and they don't have a common background. So that's something it would be. Now, if you have any questions about this educational stuff, I should answer them now, because I'm going to now go and give you a peek at another complex graph that deals with the coming PAA paper with Ursula on intergenerational effects. And I can go back and deal, or we can do that later. Okay. Well, let me just give you the tease about intergenerational. So in Sweden and Norway, we can actually go back further in the multigenerational register, and we can find out whether these mothers and fathers we've been studying here, who we were watching have children, whether their parents had children with more than one partner. And so this was Trude Lapegård's idea, and I said, okay, I'll be your research assistant in Sweden. I won't write the paper, but I'll do the analysis. So we have in Norway and Sweden multi-generational registers where each child is linked to her mother and father, and therefore each child can also be linked to all of the children of the mother and the father. And therefore, we can tell whether somebody has a half-sibling from the mother's side, the father's side, and whether the half-sibling is older or younger. So we determine, when I say children here, I'm talking about the mothers and father, the mothers I've been investigating. So they're children, but they're adult children having children. They're generation two. And we can determine whether they have half-siblings from their mother's side, half-siblings from their father's side, or both. We can determine if they have older or younger or both have siblings. And so what I'm going to present to you is the results only for Sweden. So it's just like adding deep independent variables to the previous analysis. The analysis is completely identical. It just has this extra dependent independent variable about step siblings. And because this is four categories and this is four categories, I have not done the full cross of 16 categories, but I have enough cases to do it if I want to. So I'm just going to present you results for this and results for that. And they differ, I think, in intriguing ways. Okay. Blue is constant, fixed at 1. These are the relative risk ratios. The red is if you have half-siblings only from your father. The green, if you have half-siblings only from your mother. And the purple from both. And this is the relative risk of having with the same father, mother with the same father, mother with a different father. Now we have fathers for the first time. Fathers having with the same mother, fathers having with a different mother. So these mothers and fathers are sons and daughters, if you want to think of it. They're the middle generation. This information is the first generation. And the risk is the third generation, if that makes clear. And it's completely clear that those who've grown up or had, even maybe not grown up with, but who have half-siblings are less likely to have children, the next child with the same partner, and more likely to have the next child, whatever it is, with different partners. It looks like there's not a huge difference whether you have from your mother and father, which was interesting to me because there's certain some kind of gender issues. You're more likely to have lived with the half-siblings of your mother than the half-siblings from your father. It also looks like if you have both, this means you have at least two half-siblings, obviously. So there's a little bit of a marginal effect that goes beyond having from one side or the other. And this may be, we could also sort this out, this may just be a function of the number, because there's at least two, whereas in the other categories there might be just one. And then I did the same analysis where the half-siblings are identified as older, younger, or both. And here again, the blues are constant, and it's the relative risk. And you can see again that if you have a half-sibling, you're less likely to have the next child with the same partner and more likely to have it with a different partner. And here, though, we find a different effect, so that there's a real difference between having only older half-siblings and only younger half-siblings. And if you think about it, if you have only older half-siblings, you probably or you may not have experienced your own parents' separation. If you have younger half-siblings, this has to be the combined effect of the separation and the birth of a subsequent half-sibling. So that is why it makes perfect sense. Again, we have the whole population here, so we can try to tease out some of these unique combinations to see what happens. So that's what I'm presenting to you today, so you're the first people to see this for Sweden. Norway looks virtually the same from the preliminary estimates, but I didn't have the final numbers, so I didn't want to present them. But if you're going to PAA or if you check maybe one of our websites sometime after PAA, you'll have the full paper up there. I have a summary and some ideas for discussion, but if there's any questions about this, I'd be happy to take them.
Okay. Thank you, Betty.
On this slide and the previous one, could you say something about what you think might be the mechanisms? Is it
Would it be very different if you plotted this by having experienced a divorce?
That is an excellent question. And that was one of the points that actually I thought in sort of to think about was which is the process here? Is it, am I am quite sure most of it's through union instability. But we don't know yet whether there's an additional aspect of childbearing. Now, if we take all the younger, older, we would say the difference there is the difference between the union instability effect and the having it be acceptable to have children. You grow up with half siblings, you don't think it's such a bad thing for your own child to produce a half sibling. It's not like you're going into your fertility career planning half siblings. Nobody is doing that. But it means that if you are in a situation where you've separated from the first children's other parent and you meet somebody, that your own experience might say, well, this isn't so bad. This can work, or this is appropriate. We can, with the Swedish and Norwegian data, because, I mean, I have more than, I have 1.5 million mothers that I'm looking at. And so, and even though the proportion who have half-siblings is small, it's many and plenty of cases to try to look at the timing. The only problem is, with the Swedish data, we cannot... I'm not sure about the mothers and fathers. I don't think we can. For the earlier generation, the first generation, we can find out if they had kids with more than one partner. We cannot time their separation or divorce because we don't have the data. We can only time separation if you have a common child. But we could see if your parents separated at some point, but only after 1968. And that means you're dealing with the people who, if you take the people who were having their first, let's say they were having their first, they were having the target birth in the 1970s, well, those target births wouldn't be old enough to have this happen. So we can't, the only way we can play around with this is all the combinations of mother, father, older, younger half-sibs.
I wonder how you measure separation. Because nowadays, it is very naive to use the formal separation of a marriage.
Yeah, I measure it with... I'm happy you asked that question, because I have another paper that is an R&R for demographic research on how we do it in the Swedish data. We have, for people who have children together, whom we can identify... We can go in and find out the fastighet, the building in which they lived. And we've shown with census data where people report about their household that it matches quite well. So we can look at the separations of parents after 1968 in the Swedish data, even though we don't have what the Danes have, which is apartment data on where people live. We can only look at it once a year. But it's better than focusing on divorce.
Yeah, because in many countries, with a different father might well be the best possible actual measurement of a separation. Because what else should you do? You know, of course, you have formal separation of a marriage, but that is irrelevant nowadays because so many children are born outside of marriage anyway.
Yeah.
And so therefore, I think it
I think that would be okay for the second birth, because second births, it's easy to add a second child in a step family. It's one child. I don't think it would work for third births, because third births, lots of people, whether they have a new partner or not, don't have third births. Ursula, do you remember, like, when I think that when we find that if you have couples where one of the partners has one child, they're highly likely to have a child together, creating the two-child family. But so are the couples who stayed together. So then when it comes to third births, the decline in birth parity progression ratio is very strong from 2 to 3 in the same partnership. So I don't think we could assume, if we observed no third birth, that there was no separation. On the other hand, once there's a third birth, I mean a second birth, it's highly likely, even in Sweden, that the couple is married when they've by the time they've had two children together. So you'd observe the divorce.
Things that we get the first point in sense of what the relations between the siblings are. And you may know that in fact it's quite common in this case in some other parts of the world, by people who are rethinking the fertility transition. Mm-hmm. And Arthur Wolf and a lot of other people's work on household long term is very obsessed with siblings.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what that looks like to me is, of course, we've moved into sorts of siblings, systems in which siblings are really very structural. The kinds of bonds that are very important between brothers and sisters,
mm-hmm.
which might relate, for example, to inheritance of property or control of various resources, are simply no longer an issue.
Oh, I think they're more of an issue. Because maybe not for the kinds of outcomes of family solidarity and exchange, but in fact for the conflicts around family solidarity and exchange. So regularly in the Swedish newspaper, they have a sort of advice columnist lawyer who does basically family law mostly, and it gets questions mostly about family law. And, you know, half the questions are a specific situation in which we are married, we're not married. My partner has or has not children. I have children and whatever. And what's going to happen? Because Sweden has very strict inheritance laws. You cannot disinherit your children. They have your biological or adopted children. And you don't have to give anything to your stepchildren. And your spouse or partner at the time you die gets certain rights but not other rights depending on being married. So these stepchildren, these half-siblings, I think have tremendous implication for elderly care, depending on what happened. And I'm not familiar with this literature from kind of what it sounds to me like a sort of kinship, societal point of view. I'm familiar with some studies of sibling relationships based on the half versus step versus full siblings. And I don't think there's been much done on that lately. Lynn White did an early piece, and I don't see it being more than like a little control variable in studies of other things. So one of the things that I thought here is that keeping track of the complete sibship of today's young adults and tomorrow's young adults and what those sibships mean for their access to opportunities. I mean, you could think of a half-sibling as a weak tie, especially if you didn't grow up with the half-sibling. And therefore, somebody exposed to a different network but still tied to you who gives you some more opportunities. On the other hand, there's the conflictual, you know, who's got more from the parent. So I think there's just tons of things to examine. But I have to be honest and say, I'm really interested in fertility right now. So this stuff, even though I've done a lot of work on family configuration and child outcomes, and I even just finished a big 6-year project with it, and I have a doctoral student finishing up on effects of half-sibling births on children, I really want to find out what it means at the aggregate level for fertility. And so one of the things that Edith Gray did for us, which I haven't had a chance to really figure out, is to, where is this? Well, not really decomposing parity progressions, but estimating a TFR in two pieces. TFR first partner and TFR later partners. And they should add up, right? I mean, it's just going to be the algebra, so they're going to add up to the TFR. But I think it would be fascinating to be able to do this across countries. I don't know what it would tell me exactly yet, but I just want to look at the numbers. And then something Neil said, I think the other issue is, that made me think maybe we should just put this all back in a non-competing risk framework and study it just as birth risks with the time-varying covariate of having a new partner, not just being in a partnership, but having a new partner. But that we can't do with register data, so we have to have the survey data because of cohabitation.
I've got a small technical question and a bit of clarification. And the technical question was about your proposition of children born to the same father versus a new father in the U.S. and Australia.
Yeah.
You didn't have the register data. If I remember correctly, you presume that every child born 6 months before partnership and 9 months
right,
after
the
partnership
is in those partnerships.
And I just wonder if 9 months after the partnership is not an overestimation, because that presumes that on the day of their separation they might have had sex and conceived the child, which probably...
It could be. We could play around. The reason we did it that way is in all the stepfamily research we did, that's how we assigned children. And so I wanted to do something that was comparable. But I haven't... it doesn't make a lot of difference. I mean, it's only going to be a few cases anyway who are assigned to unions that way or another way.
Okay.
So it's kind of like make a decision or not. When Gunnar Andersen did all of his nice estimates, he just said, if they're not born in the union, they're not in the union. And he didn't worry about if they were born 9 months later. They were out of union births.
Okay.
And so there's different ways you can do it, but it isn't going to change very much the overall pattern, I think.
And the other question I had is, I don't know about Swedish American laws, but was the child maintenance laws, although was there a dramatic change in child maintenance laws? You know,
no. There was a change fairly recently, not that recently. I think it was in the late 1990s, but it might have been after the turn of the century, where joint legal custody became the default. And there's very much an increase, especially, I mean, you know, Sweden is not a highly geographically mobile society in some respects, and I mean, first time I lived there, I met an elderly couple and asking them about their 5 children and where they live, and they said, oh, they live really far away. They all lived in Greater Stockholm. You know, it was just a different view than an American has when I live 2,000 miles from my grandchildren. So wechselvisboende, children going back and forth weekly or every 2 weeks has increased quite a bit out of this legal change. And several people are just beginning to study the effects of that on children.
If you have to pay so much for your child,
it hasn't changed a lot as far as I know in terms of the amount that you pay. But if your children live back and forth, nobody pays anybody because it's assumed. And there might be, you can go to civil court and make an individual arrangement with regard to that. The other interesting question in this respect, and I have a colleague at University of Wisconsin, Dan Meyer, who's an economist who does social work kind of things, and he's been doing studies of different countries' treatment of child support obligations to children in first fertile partnerships and second fertile partnerships. And it turns out, and this is something we might try to tease out, the law is different in Sweden and Norway. And one of his questions is, what happens when you have children with one partner, you're paying support, you have children with another partner, and then when you do that, do you get a break on your child support or not? Some countries you do, some you don't. In the U.S. it would be state level. And then if you leave that relationship and you have 2 obligations to 2 different households, is the obligation fixed so that each of those households loses, or did the first children have preference, or the second children, and how does that work out? And he finds significant differences across country in how that works. But I don't know the details.
Christian? Suggestions, I think.
Okay.
One is that the older and younger siblings, would the registry data allow you to look at whether they were at any time co-resident household, and then for how long? What the age difference
way of looking at
Definitely on age differences. In terms of being co-resident, I mean, one rough thing is simply still to look at whether they were siblings from the mother's side or the father's side, and then were they of an age to be in the household. That would be a very good proxy, because in some of the stepfamily work where we had information on where they lived, it because mothers, children are highly likely to live with their mothers, if you modeled co-resident and non-resident children, you got essentially the same results as if you model mothers and fathers' children, or the woman's and the man's children. In terms of, we do, children are registered at a particular building. This is the problem in Sweden, but in Norway they're registered in a particular dwelling, like an apartment. In Sweden, we don't yet have in the data, and will never have for prior years, where the apartment unit, so we only know, say, the complex or the building they lived in was different. But we would have that from 1968 on. And the issue is whether... Yes, I think we could know where the children are registered and whether, and actually I know we can because we haven't used this variable, but in the parental separation study, we decided just focus on whether the parents were together and not worry about whether the child was also living with them. But I know we have a variable that tells us whether the child is also living.
Looking at these big differences in by education, I wondered if you that you find here, whether the kind of the composition or the timing of new partner children differs by education. So my guess would be that it's that they're much closer together in low-educated mothers who have children. And it's more the kind of second round in the higher.
We could look at that just descriptively to see if that's correct. In Sweden, however, I want to show you something way back where I showed, I didn't talk about this. You notice how among women with two children, there's a very small proportion who have the second child with another partner compared to Norway. I mean, that's a significant, I mean, it's not, statistics is not in it. These are the data. In Sweden, we have a speed premium in the parental leave system that provides an incentive for having children within 30 months of each other for most women. And in fact, the incentive is stronger for low-income women who would go back to work, would not go back to work perhaps until the second child is born, than it is for highly educated women. So in that respect, you're correct that the spacing occurs. And because of that premium, I am convinced, haven't written anything about this, that what the speed premium does is it makes people say, well, we're not sure we're going to have a second child, but if we don't have it now, we're going to lose out if we decide to have it. So they have it, and therefore they have it in the same union. And in Norway, there's no such premium, so you can say, well, I'll go back to work, and we'll see how things go, and then my relationship isn't going so well, and they never have that child, or if they do, they have it with someone else.
My final thing was, you already, I think, alluded to it when you were talking about the titles of the talk.
Yeah.
I'm more familiar with the idea of model.
Oh, great, I get to show you my last slide.
So I wonder why.
I'll show you why. This, to me, is multi-partner fertility. This is Truda's picture that she uses when she uses... The other term for this is multi-partner fertility. And here's research shows a third of single moms don't mind sacrificing themselves for their kids. I wouldn't know. I don't have any time to think about it. It's very clear these children probably aren't all with the same father. Here we have the father with his two partners, and therefore lots of children, the Mormon, and I've forgotten what's this is a Greek or Norman myth, Roman myth. Does anybody know? Somebody better at art history than I am? What is it? Anyway, so In 2006, Frank Furstenberg and Marcy Carlson were presenting the draft of their paper at Wisconsin, and I was asked to be this kind of keynote. They were having a little workshop on multi-partner fertility. And I said, this is absolutely the worst term I can think of. First of all, almost all of this happens with only two, not three or four or five fathers. Almost all of it is two. Multi is inappropriate. And a little more picky, fertility is not an individual level term, it's a population term. You don't have fertility yourself. You have children. And it's the population for which we can measure fertility. And I said, to me, when you talk about fertility and you talk about multi, this is what it brings to my mind. Although I actually said it reminds me of rabbits. And so I just thought, especially because they were doing work with a somewhat disadvantaged and a higher proportion of minority, that it was a very bad political message. And so I struggled and struggled, and I didn't have to deal with it for 2 years until Truda and I and Marcy decided we would do something together. I said, I'm sorry, guys, I cannot put this term in my papers. I refuse. You have to come up with a better thing. And the best we've come up so far with is this. So I would love it if you could give me a better title. I never use acronyms if I can help it, except for organizational names in my writing. And so, but in our programs, this is called CHAP, which works fine when you're talking about the guys. It doesn't work fine when you're talking about the mothers, CHAP.
But you started off your talk by saying that these kind of things have been studied mostly from the men's perspective and the youth perspective.
Yeah.
But you showed us all these strong patterns that the lowly educated women are most likely to have these the children with other partners. Would it be the same picture if you could study it from men's perspective?
I think it would be stronger. I think it would be stronger. Yeah, because especially in Norway and Sweden, because we already know that men's education is strongly positively related to second and third births, much more than women's, because there's still some opportunity costs. And I think those are occurring in the same relationship. And I have the male data, and I've looked at the effect in Sweden, and I might have it that I could show it to you, but I think it's the same. I don't know about in the U.S. I think the Karin Gusso's paper finds that, and I'm pretty sure that Truda has reported that also, that it's more common among the low-educated. But we don't know if that's entirely due to the higher separation rates in the pool, or whether there's something else going on, because it should work in two opposite directions. The better educated men are much less likely to separate. This is true for the women. But they are more attractive in new partnerships and have the resources to produce these, to care for these extra children. So you have two opposing things going on.
So there's a very high correlation between the educational status of men and women in both all experiences.
Yes. And so, but when you just look at men and you just look at women, the male effect acts much more like an economic income effect, so it's stronger. I don't know if I've seen, surely some of our colleagues have looked at educational homogamy and the fertility outcomes, but I'm not sure.
What are you trying to measure with using the woman's educational status? You're trying to use a social economic status, and to be about the education, to be about the man from
right.
The woman's educational status is still not quite true.
Right, but I don't have education for all the women's partners, so. Yeah, but you're saying I should claim that this is a proxy for that. Now, in the register data in Sweden, I can actually get the woman's earnings for every year as well, but I think that is more problematic because the partnered women I can't get the earnings of the women who have cohabiting partners with whom they have no children. Yeah. So what would you use? Like, I can get occupation for the woman, but that still wouldn't. So.
More comments? One last question? Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I think you said that having a child within cohabitation increases.
No, what I said was cohabiting couples separate faster and more frequently than married couples, even when they've had a child together. So if you take two sets of parents that are living together, if the parents are married, they have a much lower separation rate than if they're cohabiting. The difference isn't so big in Sweden, for example, as it is in the United States. The only estimates I've seen, they're old estimates, but the estimate for the U.S. was like 3.5 times as likely. I think for Sweden it was under 2. But in every country, even when couples have children together, they have higher rates of separation.
You actually answered my question because I wanted to ask whether there are differences.
Yeah. And the thing is that I believe from most of the research that's gone on that it's a selection. So the cohabitation is just a marker for a less stable union. It's just a marker for a couple of people who are sort of more or less willing to separate if things aren't going well. And marriage is a marker for people who, you know, can't imagine not being together. They're sure they're going to get there, or they have strong ideological beliefs that they must stay together. So they marry in the Nordic context. In the U.S. context, obviously, that's not at all true.
We found, we studied induced abortions, and we found very interesting effect that cohabiting women had an induced abortion rate midway between that of single women.
Okay. And that is that's consistent with this relationship, it might not be permanent, kind of. Argument.
But before we disperse, let's thank Betty again for a very interesting
Thank you all.